Hello, Margaret. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Fantastic. So let's get straight into it. I mean, you are the queen of the property investment industry. there's so much to talk about. Can you just, to kick off, perhaps explain to our audience how you got involved and where it all started?
Sure. Look, my husband and I were living in Perth at the time. He's from Perth, and I'd moved there with my former husband. And we had started to look at our own home mortgage and decided that there had to be a better way for us to get out of debt and start moving ahead financially. We were both, you know, pretty good, pretty hard workers, but working in a job for somebody else. And we saw a system that was purported to help people get out of their mortgages more quickly. And it was a system of having a line of credit and using a credit card and pretty much what most people know about these days, but was very new, groundbreaking information back then. We're talking 1996 now. And we started to use that system on our own home and did very, very well out of it and thought, well, you know what? This is something that we think that we could probably offer to friends and relatives and people we know and help them to do it maybe for a small fee. So we began our company essentially to help people to get out of their home debt more quickly and to budget in a better way and to essentially manage their money. So I guess you could say we were financial coaches. We did that for a couple of years. We brought that over to the East Coast, moved our family here. We felt there were more opportunities. Basically started the business on a bit of a wing and a prayer, hoping that we could make that business work. And after a bit of trial and error in the beginning, we were able to make a fairly good local success out of our company, Destiny. And all we did back in those days was to help people to get out of their home mortgages or certainly reduce their debt more quickly.
I guess you've gone on from that, which is more around money management, into you know what's so much bigger than that now. So where what happened in terms of the change from money management to property investing and growing wealth that way as well?
Yeah, well, I guess it was a change that was brought about more by our clients than anything else. You know, back in those days, and we're now talking probably 1998, 1999, back in those days, people weren't really into property investing the way they are now. There'd really only been one book written on the subject, which was by Jan Summers, and she talked very much about just looking around your local area, buying something you're familiar with, buying one or two properties in order to be able to have something behind you for your retirement. And because we were getting out of our own home mortgage fairly quickly and we found ourselves with a lot of equity, we started to look around ourselves for ways to improve our financial future and fell across property and, you know, bought our first property the way many people do, through a spruiker who, you know, told us that this property was going to be the best thing since sliced bread, and we bought into it and then thought, okay, what are all the things that we did wrong, and realised pretty quickly there was a lot of things wrong with that particular property, learned a lot from that, went on to buy a few more properties of our own, and all the time started to pay attention to what we were doing and how we were doing it and what we could do better. That's the nature of how we work. And while we were doing that, our clients, who we had a fairly close relationship with, naturally watched that journey and said, well, you need to teach us how to do that too. You know, you're doing it. We don't know how to do it. Show us. And so we just began to work with our very small client base at the time, help them to invest in property. And we got to the point where our clients were becoming so successful at it that they were saying to me, you explain things so well, you should write a book. And so I did.
Right, right. Okay, so that was the basis of your first book.
Yes.
And you've gone on to obviously author many more since then. So I'm going to come back to the property spruiker thing that you just mentioned there as well, because it's a common story, isn't it, unfortunately, that a lot of people have perhaps learned about the industry through mistakes that they've made, and that seems to be an underlying factor, I think, behind many of the stories that we do here. But yeah. let's just keep going with the background a little deeper. I mean, you know, now it's an enormous investment property portfolio that you've built for you and your family. you've authored many more books that, like we spoke about, you're obviously the host of two very popular property investment shows on Sky News Business. Mm-hmm. You're not the first person to have like thought of improving their wealth and starting a small business. And, you know, what is it, do you think, that's kind of propelled your success at the trajectory that you have experienced? It's obviously extremely unique.
Yeah, look, and I'm quite confident that I know the reason why we've succeeded where others may not have. And, mm-hmm. I mean, our company is a national company and has been for a long time now. And there's no question that having a couple of book titles back in the day when writing a book was really something you did just because you could write a book and it was only published if it was a good book. These days, with self-publishing the way it is, every man and his dog has a book. So a book is no longer that credibility factor that it used to be when I wrote my first book. You know, getting a book published when I had my first book was a massive thing. Finding a publisher who was willing to take it on and take on the risk, it was a very, very big thing. And if someone did take that risk on, it meant that they felt you had a book that was worthwhile and that could do something. So having a book definitely helped to, I guess, get my strategies known more widely throughout the country. But I think the reason that what we've done has been so successful, I think there's a number of reasons. Firstly, I've never been one to just listen to someone else and copy it and say, this is how you invest in property. I've always really looked more deeply into what I've been doing, what other people do investing in property, and try to work out what it all means in terms of the best way to buy property. And because I'm also a financial advisor, a qualified financial advisor, I've then overlaid all of that stuff that we tend to do a little bit emotionally and out of instinct against an economic backdrop so that I can work out what truly drives growth and help people to invest in areas that are going to be the hotspots of tomorrow. There's no point in investing in a hotspot of today or somewhere that the magazines are talking about because it's too late. You're not going to make the best amount of money out of that. And then on top of that, I also have a training and development background. So I've really wanted to be able to coach people into being able to work out how to actually become better investors themselves and not hand over the responsibility of making investment decisions to somebody else who's probably got their own best interests at heart. And in some ways, that's been a double-edged sword for us because particularly these days when people are so time poor, people want other people to do things for them. They don't want to take that responsibility. They don't want to take the time that you need to learn how to be a better property investor. And so many, many other companies have now come through and are probably just as successful or more so than we are. And they prey on people who don't want to do any work themselves. They make huge amounts of money from developers. They act on both sides of the transaction for the buyer and for the seller, which I think is terribly, I think that's just plain wrong. But we've stuck to that old strategy of just providing really good quality education that means something. And because we would never act on the other side of a transaction, then we are absolutely advocates for our clients, and our clients can know and trust that anything that we're recommending to them, any strategy that we're recommending to them, comes totally without any commissions on the other side and therefore is truly independent and quality information. So, you know, yeah. I think, and it comes about always being at the forefront. I spend a lot of time examining the markets and trying to establish what's really going on and understanding that the property market is so ever-changing that there's no point in having a view, an opinion or a strategy that you never change. You know, the things I talk about today are probably different than what I talked about when I began and in some cases contrary to what I spoke about when I began. And that's not because I've changed my mind or think I was wrong back then. It's because the property landscape has changed and how we access it and buy property has to change too.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, just picking up on one point you made there regarding being completely independent in the process, we've come across so many cases whereby, you know, say, for example, a client has purchased an investment property and we've had a low val come back on that on that investment purchase.
And
then, you know, you start looking a little bit deeper. You know, the advocate there reported to buy well, and it was a fantastic opportunity, et cetera, only to then realize that, you know, all of these developer margins and referral fees and kickbacks and everything is has been embedded to the purchase price, hence the actual underlying value of what was purchased was much less. And you probably are well across all of those details, not just in the line of your work, but also with your involvement in PIPA, because you're the former chair and are still on the board there, is that right?
Well, yeah, look, I'm pretty much the person who began PIPA. A couple of other people began it, but they did begin it for their own ends. And when I came on the board, I quickly got rid of those people, and we were born again, and we started again.
Yep.
But, you know,
yep.
you talk about those commissions, and the thing is, those spruikers are very, very good at what they do. And if you could bottle the way they sold property, then you'd have a great sales program on your hands. And they're very good at convincing investors that not only is the property that they just happen to have on their books the perfect property for that client, but that they're going to be getting it at a great value, and that the developer is paying them from developer profit, not from the purchase price of the property. And you have to be fairly naive to believe that. The money, the developer isn't going to give up his profits just to sell property. He's in it to make profits, and it will definitely be absolutely added to the purchase price. And it's easily proven. If those same clients who think they're time poor just took a little bit of time to do some recent sales research, they would discover that very, very similar properties, maybe a year old, are selling for far less just around the corner.
I'm actually helping
someone at the moment. At PIPA, one of the things that we try to do is we advocate for clients or for investors who may have had a bad experience, and try to help them navigate the very murky waters of, you know, what can you do to protect yourself, or to get some kind of recompense if you've received some bad advice. And of course, at the moment, there's very little, because there is no law, there's no legislation under which someone can be pursued. But I'm dealing with a client at the moment who spoke with a very, very well-known property company who's all over the internet and throughout all of the magazines and has an appearance of being highly credible. They explained to them that they had a very, very cautious risk profile. They were risk averse. They explained to them that what they really wanted to do was just buy a property in Sydney, and they were using their self-managed super fund to do so, and it's the only money they have. Now, this company sold them, talked them out of Sydney. This is 2 years ago, talked them out of Sydney, sold them a property in Gladstone, and when they signed the contracts, hidden in the end of the contract was a clause that stated that for the privilege of these people finding this property for them, they were going to pay them $10,000. And then on top of that, they now know that this particular company also reaped a huge commission from the developer in the realm of about $30,000. And now they're stuck with a property that has gone back 55% in its rental yield and probably about 40% in its value.
And Sydney, on the other hand,
50-60%
in the same time.
But obviously this particular spruiker didn't have any property available in Sydney to sell to them. So now...
Well, that's right. It's got nothing to do with the person's unique circumstances. It's purely what they've got on their book to sell. And hence, completely biased.
Absolutely. And if this were a financial advisor who did this, there would be a process for recompense, because financial advising is very, very well regulated. But because it's a property advisor, there's nothing that this person can do in order to get back any of that money for that very bad and inappropriate advice that they received.
Really interesting, and probably also goes to just the importance of building a good team and not just relying on one individual person. You know, if there's a team that perhaps includes a proficient mortgage broker, a well-qualified and respectable buyer's advocate, you know, the right lawyers, wealth accountants, et cetera, the risks of perhaps falling into traps like that are going to be minimised.
Think you need the buyer's advocate at all, to be honest. I think that that's just as dangerous. And buyer's advocates are going to charge you a price per property that they buy. That's going to add to your bottom line. I think you need to be educated. You can become as educated as a buyer's advocate fairly simply by doing the right kinds of education and courses and reading the right kinds of books. So I do think that while there are some professionals that you do need, a good conveyancer, a good quantity surveyor, a good property manager, a good building inspector, I think there's a lot of people in the property industry at the moment who are extraneous. They're only in it for their own benefit, and there's a pretty simple process to weed them out. If there's more in it for them than there is in it for you, then don't use them. And if they're involved in selling as well as buying for you, don't be involved with them.
That's really interesting. So let's pick up on that. A couple of quick points. But before the show, we were talking about to be a property expert and to be completely unbiased in one's advice. Obviously, we need to be thinking about the national property market. We can't be isolated to the particular geography that happens to be nearby or that we're most familiar with, because obviously then we're isolated just to the opportunities in that isolated market, and we could be missing what else is open and available elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So how would you kind of relate what you just were talking about to the person that, say, might be Sydney-based today, mm-hmm. And they've just experienced the market grow very significantly over the last 2 to 3 years? There may be a sense that the market is at a higher point in the cycle, and for whatever reason that they may be interested in buying an investment property in interstate market. But obviously, being busy, time poor, they're they don't know. Aside from realestate.com.au and perhaps a couple of people in the industry here and there that they may know of and can rely on for information and advice, it's difficult for them to invest interstate. How would you recommend that a person like that goes about conducting their own research and perhaps pursuing an opportunity like that?
Okay, so there'll be a little bit of bias in my answer here, of course, because, I think that we have the solution and we've been working on it for a very long time. But the first point that I would like to make from that is that if you're time poor, you have no business investing in property. Go and do something else, because it requires time. And you might say, well, I don't have the time. Then if you don't have the time, you are going to invest badly in property. There is no question about that. Through my work with Pippa, I come across so many people who have really been ripped off badly. And you can always track it back to the fact that the investor made bad decisions about how they were going to buy because they were time poor, or because they couldn't be bothered taking the process that they needed to take to learn more about what they were doing. Now, I always use this as an analogy. Can you imagine if you decided you wanted to become a doctor, but you couldn't be bothered doing the 6 years at uni? So instead you thought, well, the best way for me to do it is to just be hands-on from the beginning. How about I carry out an appendectomy to get started? It's an easy operation. I'll start there and I'll see how that goes for me. Now that sounds
alarm
bizarre.
Alarm bells. It does.
It sounds bizarre. However, most property investors start exactly that way. They say, well, I don't have time. I haven't got the time to go and do that education. I'll just buy a property. They start their property investing by buying a property. Now that's a big risk, because a property investment is a very expensive thing to get. And even when you're using mostly the bank's money, it's the negative properties, or the ones that don't turn out well, that end up costing you an awful lot of money and can completely ruin your entire financial future. It can put you backwards 20 years if you do it badly. So if you decide you want to become a property investor, it shouldn't be because one day you are on holiday somewhere and you walked past the sales office of the latest high rise and thought, oh, they're selling properties, they're quoting a good return, maybe it's time I became an investor. That's the worst way to get started. What you should do is say, I'm going to become a property investor, so I'm going to spend a good year learning how to do this right. Once you've done that, buying away from home is not only very easy, but it's imperative to do so. Nobody really lives in a hotspot or a future hotspot. And, most of those areas that become good hotspots in the future are areas that even the locals don't like now. But they have the fundamentals and what I call the growth drivers to become a good area in the future. And you can learn how to recognize those growth drivers. And because they have nothing to do with what you see, more to do with what you know, you don't have to be anywhere near the property to recognise them.
Yeah, really good. So And we're going to provide some links in the show notes at the bottom of the post here. But just for the benefit of our audience while we are on the topic, where would you recommend people start, perhaps in terms of your own literature? Where might people start? What would the first book perhaps that you've written be that you'd recommend to get started to learn more about this?
Okay, so my last book is my first three books revised, all in the one. My first three books were part of a how-to series that started with the very basics in the beginning and basically introduced people to property investing at a time when few people really approached property investing with an economic perspective. It was back in a time when we bought very emotionally, which still happens today, but we bought emotionally because we thought, okay, I think I'll become a property investor and the house next door is on the market and, hey, well, this is a great area. I live here, so I might buy that house. So I was trying to encourage people away from that thought process when I wrote the first book, and I gave them some quite basic information about finances, about money management and about investing in property and, you know, what makes a good property and the process. Then I wrote a second book which expanded on that and took it a little further. And then the third book was really for people who'd already started to invest in property, had a bit of a portfolio and for some reason might have hit a bit of a brick wall and didn't know how to continue to expand that portfolio. So it included advanced information about structures and about advanced financing concepts. So I took those three books, and rather than rewrite each one, I just combined them all into one book that has three categories in it, the beginner, the intermediate, and the advanced category. And it's a really good all-round guide. But the thing is, knowing what to do is one thing, but knowing how to do it is another. And so we developed the Essential Property Education course, which we've been running for years now, and people absolutely love it. It's a weekend course. 2-day course, and people come out of that really ready to just jump straight into researching for the next property. And I've recently, in light of, you know, the fact that I recognize people being kind of poor and some people don't want to spend a weekend locked away when, you know, weekend might be the only time off they get. So I've recently developed that into a really fabulous online course that isn't just a series of, you know, badly filmed webinars, which most of these property experts online material is. Fortunately, because of my involvement in the show, I have my own TV studio. We've been able to create incredibly high quality tutorials. We've created them all together in a fabulous authoring tool that includes activities and all sorts of things. It's very engaging. It's very interesting. And then we've mounted it all up on a high-tech learning platform that enables self-paced delivery. And people can, you know, can come online, access that course, start up the first tutorial, do it in their own time, start and stop whenever they like. And it really has solved that problem of how do I get this information and education without me having to go and commit half my life to get it.
Yeah, fantastic. So would you say, Margaret, that really in essence that is what separates Destiny from other property companies out there, the education focus?
Absolutely. And yeah, if a company out there tells you that they're educators, they're probably not if they also become involved in the buying process. If they're saying, oh, you know, we educate you and support you, but we just happen to have all these properties that you can buy, then the education and support function that they have is a marketing function. It's purely to get you in, because the big money for them is definitely made through the selling of property. For us, we just have fee for service, education, and if you need it afterward, support to help you buy the properties. We don't show you where to buy the properties, but as you're finding them, we help you to analyze them, make sure that you don't get it wrong, help you to negotiate the price, because a lot of people don't realize that the first money you make in property is on the way in. And if you can't access a property under its market value, then you haven't made money going in. We teach people how to do that, how to then get the right team around them, how to get the conveyancing done in a timely fashion. We obviously have a finance broking department as well, so that we can make sure that people get the right finance. 80% of people who come to us with a property already in place have the wrong loans, which is also very costly. So it's all about just being able to help people to see that buying property is such a big process. It can't be managed carelessly. It can't be done in 5 minutes on a weekend. It has to have a huge amount of commitment. And if you can commit and get yourself into what I call the property headspace on a regular basis, then you will be more successful. Surround yourself by other people who are doing what you're doing. Really commit time to property investing just as you would to a second job. Then you will be successful.
Yeah, love it. I really do. I mean, it's a terrific model. Obviously, it's been enormously successful, and we at Long Property here are very big advocates of self-education as well. Well, education in general, and, you know, as I said earlier, we'd be more than happy to put the right links there so that people can learn more about Destiny and exactly what that offering looks like. Also, Margaret, you mentioned the latest book being like a summary of the first three. Just to confirm, that's the title, How to Achieve Property Success. Is that right?
That's right, yes. Yeah. And it's, I guess, a kind of a spin-off from the show Property Success with Margaret Lomas. We're now just tying up our 8th year of Property Success. So it's been a very, very successful show. A lot of people don't realise that I actually don't get paid for doing any of my Sky News work. So Monday nights, I host a live show. I'm not paid for that. And Property Success, I actually pay to produce that myself. And Sky News just gives me the free airtime. Now, a lot of people don't understand why I do that. And the truth of the matter is that the property industry itself has been very good to me in terms of, first of all, the properties that I've bought. So as you so rightly pointed out, I do own a lot of property. It's all been very good for me. People say, well, you know, it was the right time for you, but it's always the right time to buy property. You just have to know how to buy it well. And I've been fortunate that I've made some very, very good purchases. I've made a couple of bad ones as well, but I've made far more good ones than I've made bad ones. And, of course, you know, my business has been very good to me as well. And while we certainly don't make anywhere near the kinds of money that Spruikers make, we make enough money to make a fairly good living and to keep 27 families employed as well, which we're quite proud of. And so being able to do the shows for me is a way to giving back to that industry and giving back to the community so that they can get that free, unbiased information without feeling that they have to be marketed to. You know, I talk about Destiny on the show every now and then, but it isn't a Destiny show. It's an educational show, a property education show. And I produce that and pay for that to be produced because I really am concerned about property investors and I just want them to get the message.
Yeah, excellent. Really like that. So now we're almost out of time, but this is terrific, and there's still a couple of questions that I'd love to ask. Do you still have another 10 minutes, Margaret? Can we keep going briefly?
No problem.
Fantastic. So you just alluded there to your own personal portfolio, and I'd love to just discuss that in a little bit more detail. What we typically do at Long Property is we ask our guests just to select a particular investment that has been memorable to them in some way. Maybe it's one of your own or perhaps that you experienced with one of your clients at Destiny, but it stood out for you. You learned some great lessons, some lessons that might be worth sharing to at least to our audience here. Is there something that comes to mind that we could just dig into a little bit on the show?
The thing is, I have memories around every investment I've ever made. And I've learned lessons from every single investment that I've ever made. And I think the reason that I can turn around and give what I think is pretty good advice to other people is because I am doing what they're doing every day. I'm still active. And I've done it the way everybody else does it. I didn't have a whole pile of money that I was able to suddenly buy all these properties with. We started our first one with equity from our own home that was very hard won through debt reduction. We didn't buy a good property in the beginning and it set us back a little while and we had to learn from that. But every single property that I buy exactly the way everybody else buys it. I sit down and spend hours and hours on the research, first of all into the area. Then I narrow it down to a property. You know, property choice comes last, not first. So
yep,
narrow
absolutely.
It down to choice of property. Then once I bought it and a couple of months later, a year later, I'll look back on it and think, okay, how was that property? in relation to what else I could have bought at the time, because whenever I make a choice on a property, it's always at the cost of one that I don't buy. So I like to go back and look at how the ones I didn't buy went. Did I make the right choice? And if I didn't, why didn't I? What did I do wrong? I guess, you know, my very first property was sold to us. We were sitting ducks, really. We decided that we wanted to buy property as an investment. We mentioned it to somebody who was in, I guess, in the mortgage industry at the time, because we were fairly involved in our clients' home loans and restructuring them and setting them up in better ways. And they said to me, oh, look, I know a guy who can, you know, who's got some properties that you might be interested in. And so the guy came to the house. He was, you know, wearing a brown suit, which should have really alerted me right from the beginning to something being wrong there. And sat down and showed us this fabulous property in Cairns, of all places, and proceeded to give us all of the reasons why Cairns was the best place to be buying and what yield it was going to give us and how it was going to grow by X amount per year. And we took all of that as gospel. And surprisingly enough, given that we're both such analytical people, we didn't even cross-check the information that was being given to us. It was presented to us incredibly professionally. It looked fabulous. And we bought a property off the plan. Now, that hasn't been such a lemon that it has caused me financial distress. But we paid $161,000 for that property. And that was 16 years ago now, nearly 17 years ago. And I think 3 years or 2 years after we bought it, it was worth 140. And I'm under no illusions that the differential was the commission that the Spruiker received. And it was probably only worth 140 when I bought it. And then, you know, a couple of years later, I think in the 17 years, the peak has been when it was valued by the bank at 225. And if I wanted to sell that property today, I'd probably sell it for $165. So I've made $4,000 in 17 years. And the only
less all your running costs, less all the stamp duty. Yeah.
Well, look, the only saving grace is that because Cairns has an itinerant population, it does have a slightly higher rental yield. So it's always been a positive cash flow. We've had some big rents over the years. At one point in time, I think for 7 years, we had a permanent lease by a local bank. I think it was the Commonwealth Bank who put their managers in there. Mm-hmm. And we were getting, you know, it's slightly above premium. I think, you know, it was $161,000 buy, and I think we were getting $320 a week. So the rent returns have been very good in comparison to the buying price, which has been the only thing that sort of saved us. But, you know, people love positive cash flow, and me just as much as anybody else. But if all you're getting from a property is a positive cash flow, it does nothing to improve your net worth, and it doesn't set you up for retirement. All that does is pays your costs along the way. What's the point in having a property that pays its costs along the way, but at the end of the period, it hasn't changed in value? There's nothing to gain from that except headaches along the way.
Yeah, they're really interesting. And I mean, there are obviously two schools of thought, aren't there? Cash flow or growth. You seem, though, to find a happy medium, and you don't feel that they're both mutually exclusive. Is that right? You're always looking for growth, but still want to put cash in your back pocket.
Yeah, look, they're definitely not mutually exclusive. In some areas, they are, sure. Your big capital cities, where you are close to the city, will always have a value that is far too high to get a suitable yield. And that's because while values are all about demand, rents tend to be more linked to incomes. There's only a certain amount of rent you can charge before you'll have no tenants who can afford it. So rents are more linked to incomes, and they tend to rise more with CPI than they do rise with property values. You know, if you were able to say, well, all property returns 5%, that would be great. You could buy any property for any price and see the same return, but that doesn't happen. So the higher the price, the lower the relative yield tends to be. People have an impression that if you buy in the city, it's always going to grow. That's not true. You know, between 2003 and 2010, Sydney had a dismal 17% over the whole period. Everyone seems to have conveniently forgotten that right now when they talk about Sydney as being the best market. But, you know, those people who lived through it will know what I'm talking about.
Sure.
But there are definitely areas that will grow really well but have such a bad yield that you're going to pay for that growth. I've recently sold a property that I bought many, many years ago just to be a Sydney base for me. So I didn't buy it thinking it was ever going to be a very good investment at all. And for a long time, it wasn't, because I bought it before 2003 and it sat, or no, I actually bought it in 2006, I think, but it sat for a while with nothing happening. Yeah. Now, I've just recently sold that for just shy of $2 million to someone who's going to be getting $900 a week rent on it. You think about that, it's going to cost them after tax $40,000 a year to hold that property.
Very expensive.
It's going to have to go up by, if you think about money in terms of its after tax value, it's going to have to go up by $60,000 a year just for that person to break even. And I don't see that happening. It just can't happen. And so if you're going to pay a lot of money for a property with a low relative rental yield, it's not going to come out very well for you unless your market timing is impeccable, unless you get in right at the beginning of a great boom and get out right at the end of it. So now, on the other hand, there are definitely areas that have very, very high cash flows, and generally they're one industry towns that won't grow because they have more renters than buyers. There's so many areas where the rental yield's pretty good because the value is low. And that area also has an exceptional number of fundamentals, which show that it is a future growth area. You know, population that is growing faster than the national average, median household income that's growing faster than inflation, showing that the people there are becoming more affluent, low unemployment rates, and a diversity of industry, and a council who is really providing some great future infrastructure for their community. There are areas that have to grow. There's no reason why they wouldn't grow, and you can often buy in them at an affordable price with a cash flow that means that at least you don't have to put any money in every week.
Yeah, yeah, great. So Margaret, just to finish off then, last question. In terms of the markets and where you're starting to, or you and or your clients are starting to do some more research. We're at an interesting time. We've obviously got interest rates that are at all-time lows and perhaps going to fall again, even before the end of the year. Foreign investment has been a really big theme, hasn't it, particularly in Melbourne and Sydney markets over the last couple of years. So arguably that's driven up prices. And then also, I mean, you mentioned the low yield that the person who purchased that Sydney property from you is going to be receiving with the house price growth. I think that's also like an interesting point, isn't it? Just a lot of investment activity over the last couple of years, but now, you know, entering into a market whereby the running costs of properties like that are going to make it quite difficult for many investors to enter, you know, some of the big cap city markets. So what are you thinking in terms of, you know, the next 6 to 12 months in terms of where we can start doing some more research? Say you've got $100,000 saved up as a deposit and you're ready to go. What would you suggest?
Okay, so first of all, people often see me as a person who invests in the regions, but to clarify, I only do that when the timing is right, and it hasn't been right in the regions for a while. We did have a period of time a fair while ago where people made a lot of money out of investing in some of those bigger regional centres that grew very, very well, and the advice was sound to invest in them at the time. But now's not the time for them, I don't believe at all. I always find it interesting, just to give you an example of some things that often happened to me. I had someone else in the property industry who I quite like come to me a couple of months ago, and he said, I have a bone to pick with you. And I said, well, why? And he said, well, you've stolen one of our hotspots. And I went, really? Where is it? And he said, well, it's Logan. I went, really? That's one of your hotspots, is it? And he said, yeah, well, we've been telling our clients about Logan for the last 18 months. And I said to him, well, it might be news to you to know that I bought in Logan 8 years ago, which is when we told all of our clients to buy in Logan.
Maybe he's copied you, Margaret.
Yeah. And the clients who have bought in Logan at that time have all had their property almost double in value since buying. Now, the point that I guess I'm trying to make is that what I try to do is I try to look ahead and be recommending areas that are going to be good in the future, and everybody else then starts talking about them 4 years later as if it's, you know, fabulous news and, oh, did you know about this area? You know, at the moment, everybody's talking about Brisbane. Well, if you go back over past episodes of Property Success, you'll see that 3 years ago, we started directing people up to Deception Bay and the Moreton Bay Shire in general. And even prior to 3 years ago, we were certainly directing people into Kalanga and North Lakes and some of those areas where people have actually made some really good gain on their investment in the meantime. And when they bought in, they were getting really strong 6.5% yields on their properties. Of course, now with the rise in value, the yields are down around 5, but not for the investors who bought there all those years ago. So now what I'm seeing, and this is probably contrary to what other experts are saying, I'm seeing a lot of value in many of the Melbourne suburbs. And it's masked a little because the Melbourne apartment market is so abysmal that it's just skewing the figures. When you do a Melbourne figure, the apartment market drags that figure down incredibly. But the point is you've got to look for value pockets, and there's a lot of value pockets in Melbourne at the moment, and that includes areas down around Carrum Downs and in behind Paterson Lakes there, where you've got a really diverse market. You've got all along the foreshore at Paterson Lakes there, you've got houses that are selling for $700,000, and you only have to come back 5 minutes into Carrum Downs and it's half that. Yet we still get some really good yields, and areas like that, when they're in behind pockets of high value areas, tend to get dragged up by those areas. Once those areas become too expensive, people buy the older homes in some of those suburbs that are formerly not so fancied by the locals. They do them up, or they subdivide them and renovate them, and there's a big change in what happens in those areas. So I'm really liking those southeastern suburbs of Melbourne at the moment. I don't mind some of the western suburbs of Melbourne either, Altona Meadows, Deer Park, all around there. I think they're just right in the line of some terrific infrastructure development. Yeah. And people
Deer Park,
are starting
sunshine.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. People are starting to see the very easy commute that it affords. You know, the fact that there's a big rail hub now that's gone into Sunshine there. So I think, you know, I really like a lot of those as well. I still think there's value in the southern suburbs of Adelaide. I know we've waited a long time for it. There's some more strong economic news coming out. But if you're a person who doesn't mind doing a small development, there's some great opportunity to buy blocks down there in the Yonkerpuringa Shire that you can put up to 4 units on if you've got a mind to doing that. You know, in my own portfolio, I've spent a lot of time accumulating property, and the last 5 years, many of the properties I accumulated were with a view to being able to get the kinds of property that could one day lend themselves to future development. And I've now started some of those developments. I'm doing an 8-unit development down in South Australia at the moment, and I've just secured a block to do a second 4-unit development. So, you know, it's a natural development, I think, for many property investors to go from being just property buyers into being small property developers as well.
Yeah, really interesting. How far is the area that you just mentioned, sorry, Margaret, away from Adelaide CBD?
Okay, so it used to be a lot further because they had a freeway that went one way in the morning and a different way in the afternoon. Bizarrely enough, they've just made that into a dual freeway now. You can go both ways anytime. And providing you're not in peak hour traffic, you can do that trip in about 18 minutes. Peak hour will extend that out to over 30. But there's a rail line down there as well. It's not that far. Certainly by Sydney and Melbourne standards, it's very close. Lots of lovely coastline there as well, and buying prices of, you know, mid to low 3s with very, very good rental returns as well. So you can buy something on a fairly big block, sit on it for a couple of years until you're ready, getting a nice rental yield, and one day develop that into something that's going to give you a fair bit of cash flow. The thing about Adelaide is Adelaide probably isn't going to ever boom. Although everyone said that about Perth and look what happened there, but it always does grow just a little bit every year. So if you're a conservative investor, it's a really nice, safe little one to have in your portfolio.
Yeah, I really like that as well, the story. I mean, when you mention Adelaide to people, a lot of people are quite alarmed at Adelaide, you know, and you're right, it's never going to be the Melbourne or Sydney, but if you look at the historical returns, the price growth in Adelaide, you're exactly right. It does tick away and it performs quite well, but then, you know, over the last, say, 5 or 7 years, in comparison to that long-term trend, it is actually tracking a little below that, which may suggest that it's at an earlier point in the cycle, which is a great
thing. But you know what? You're probably doing what everybody does. it's tracked at about a 3.5 to 4% growth rate, which is pretty good, but everybody just looks at growth. If you add to that the fact that in the areas that I'm talking about, you're going to be getting a 6% rental yield, and the true rental yield is actually higher than that when you consider an after-tax rental yield where you've got a positive cash flow that actually adds to the cash flow rather than takes it away. Mm-hmm. But if you can get a 6% rental yield and a 4% growth a year, who doesn't want 10% a year on their money? How are you not? How are you going to get that anywhere else?
You're definitely not. Certainly not that house in Sydney that you just mentioned.
That's right. Exactly. That person actually is probably going to get very little growth, and then whatever rental yield they're getting is going to strip money out of that growth rate anyway. So their net return is going to be much smaller. People don't seem to ever look at that combination return, which to me is a vital figure for you to consider.
Yeah, it is really important. And then just lastly, the other two things on Adelaide that I personally quite like is the amount of infrastructure spend I think that's going into Adelaide now is quite strong relative to GDP. I believe it's higher than any of the other cap cities in Australia at the moment. There have been some unemployment issues, but my understanding is off the back of that infrastructure spend that it's recently just reversed and is now showing some positive signs for the first time in a while. Sorry, Margaret, you go.
Yeah, no, and I was going to say, and you know what, everybody goes, oh, but why would you invest in Adelaide when they're closing the Holden plant? I mean, please. The Holden plant employs 2,000 people and 1 million people live in Adelaide. So... Yeah. I don't understand that thinking. The same thinking goes for Corio in Victoria, closing the Ford plant. And some property experts have predicted a huge employment problem. And when you ask them why, they say, because the Ford plant is closing, the car manufacturing industry. I mean, really? The government is pouring a lot of money into dealing with those issues anyway, but not everybody works for Holden and Ford.
Yeah,
very few people do, relatively speaking. And when BHP closed in Newcastle, which was a much bigger employer, it was a tiny little blip on the horizon and it did nothing to property values in Newcastle.
Yeah, really interesting. And I mean, Corio and Norlane, they're so close to Melbourne CBD now. And with the growth that Melbourne, like pockets of Melbourne, not all, the market, Melbourne's so fragmented, isn't it? I mean, you've got the school belts and the inner east, and you've seen enormous price growth in the Albert Parks and the Middle Parks and whatnot. But then, there are a lot of areas, you mentioned quite a few out west and even in the further southeast that haven't moved much at all in the last 5 years. And Geelong is case in point. So there's a lot of commuter towns like Norlane, Corio, Hamlin Heights, Bellpost Hill that a lot of people are starting to talk about now as well.
And people have to prepare for a change in Melbourne anyway. Typically, Melbourne in the past has gone that, people are very emotive about property in Melbourne. You only have to see the amount of auctions that happen in Melbourne to understand that. An auction is a very emotive process, and people love their property just the same way that they love their football in Melbourne. So it is different. But what we're now seeing is a different influence on property with a lot of external investors coming into that market who don't have that same emotional connection to property, and therefore the way property is bought is going to be happening differently. So we have to consider the emotional influence of property owners versus the unemotional influence of property investors. And as property investors seek more and more value property, they're going to be drawn to some of those areas of Melbourne where the values are quite low, the population is quite dense and family oriented, and they're just ready to grow in a way that Melbourne people haven't seen before.
Yeah, really good. So, Margaret, thanks so much for your time. Is there any last comments or anything to finish off that you'd like to say to our audience?
I just want to reiterate that really the ability to be successful as a property investor starts with the property investor taking responsibility for that investment. And if you think about it, people put a lot of time into a job where they're making someone else wealthy, and yet they put off their own education into property investing when it's a vehicle that will actually make them wealthy and help them to stop working for that other person. You can't put it off. Property investing and becoming educated in property can't be the thing you do last in your week. It has to be the thing you do second between working and eating. So work, property invest, and then eat and sleep. And if you can provide that amount of attention to your property journey, you will be successful.
I like it. And as you said in your book, one of the takeaways for me in how to achieve property success was around the idea of if you do nothing, it can actually be higher risk than taking the risk itself.
So, absolutely.
We do have to get up our backsides and get moving. Margaret Lomas, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Have a good day. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.